and welcome back to Living on the Edge. Join your host, Jake Beck, Product Manager at Ambassador Labs. This is your podcast for all things related to Kubernetes, developer tooling, API gateways, service mesh implementation, and more. Let's get into it.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Living on the Edge. We are here today with Jason Harmon, the CTO of Stoplight. Jason, if you want to go ahead and introduce yourself a little bit further, that would be great.
Yeah, sure thing. So my name is Jason Harmon. You already said that. You already said I'm CTO at Stoplight, so that part's done. I think the, let's say, second half of my 25, 30 years in tech has been primarily focused on kind of, you know, building platforms, designing APIs has kind of been, you know, my mainstay. Certainly done a lot of other things, but I think bigger places like PayPal and Expedia Group, and then kind of lots and lots of startups in there too. So done quite a bit with UShip and obviously Stoplight. So APIs are kind of my weird obsession.
Easy question right off the bat. What led to that like obsession? I personally also really, really like APIs, like especially just like when I write code and stuff, like I just go to APIs because that's just like what I find interesting. So I'm really curious how you got there.
Yeah, what's funny is in, I think, kind of like late 90s, early 2000s, kind of off the back of like the .com bust, right? And we kind of had this like the makings of Web 2.0 coming. You had kind of the emergence of SOAP. And so I was definitely like, I was still pretty early in my career in, when that kind of hit. So I wasn't like, you know, Mr. Great at SOA stuff, but I kept having to kind of build services to connect things and integrate with different services, primarily for kind of closed door integrations. And, you know, my tagline for this used to be like, you know, integration is it's a messy, dirty business that no one likes to talk about. And it was. And I think when stuff like the Twitter REST API and a couple of these other things came out, it was kind of like, what is this? Because this is better. And then we used to go to a Java conference, and I'm going to forget the name of it now, back when I was doing Java for a couple of years at AT&T. And we saw a guy named Brian Sletten, who was like ideologue of ideologues on this idea of the semantic web, that everything would be self-describing and self-connecting. And man, I was like, yeah, I'm in. This makes sense. Now, I think some of the kind of, you know, the hypermedia everything and semantic everything, I'm like, yeah, not so much. But this is so much easier to deal with than SOAP stuff. And then I think the resource-oriented design, I can't even explain to you how much it just clicked that I'm like, oh, this is how I've been trying to do SOAP stuff, and they keep yelling at me, and now I'm allowed to do it. So I think just that resource-oriented design is just kind of in my DNA.
Yeah. No, and that's like honestly like my favorite part is like, I think if you think about APIs just like from like the ground up, like if you just think of it as like resource-oriented, I think it gets pretty easy to design properly. It's just as soon as you forget that concept, it's really easy to go way off rails. And like that's like the hard part is to keep like almost like keep tunnel vision on like the, like this is supposed to be resource focused. Like you need to be referencing a resource. And
yeah, I mean, I honestly think about it in a lot of ways. Like the thing that guides me through it all the time is actually some of the first things that I read about object-oriented design. Because what's unique and special is that it's not code-centric, right? So APIs basically led me to stop coding, which is weird. Because like the principles of designing them meant I had to stop thinking about particular languages because they've all got their quirks. They've all got their little syntactical sugar and invisible magic, right? That you can't use when it's time to say this will work with any language. And so you go down to just the most fundamental object-oriented principles in a lot of ways. And one of those fundamental principles is let's, you know, call the thing a noun that it is and describe what it does. Right. So to me, it's really simple in some ways.
Yeah. I think that makes so much sense. And I got to say, I get the benefit of I'm newer in the tech industry, so I've got to really take in all the evolution that's been done and not be part of paving the way for it. So I get the benefit of there's a lot of literature and people like you that go out and do so much stuff about how to properly design APIs and everything, which kind of leads me when you're building an API, I guess I'm assuming what you think is the most important part is actually the true design, right? So what actually makes...
That's not exactly fair. I think it's the part that for whatever reason I've been naturally good at and had lots of practice at. I think there's plenty of other important things about building APIs, but it's the first thing.
Yeah.
Right? So if you get the first thing wrong, you know, it's kind of like in racing, you know, if you go into a series of corners and you start the first corner wrong, everything else falls apart. And so I think that's why it's really important. It just kind of sets the pace and tone of how everything else is going to go.
Yeah, no, I think the racing analogy is there. Like, I'm a racing fan, so it definitely makes sense to me, like right off the bat. But I'm sure there's plenty of people that might not follow. But yeah, like you said, it's like if it's a series of corners, especially like S's, like if you miss that first one, you're going to be slow through the rest of them. And it's kind of the same way with not even just like APIs, just design principles in general. Like if you start with a bad design of basically anything, you're kind of setting yourself up for failure in the long term.
Yeah, for sure. And that's the other weird thing is it's a primitive form of design in a lot of ways because there's very little, right? The surface area is so lean that, you know, any extra decoration or anything, you just don't have a lot of room to move.
Right.
So it makes the ideas very salient.
Right. So what makes an API well-designed in your opinion?
I think it's like anything else that's well-designed. It's obvious. Don't make me think. Right. So I always say if I look at the URL that's provided for a given operation, it should read like a sentence. I should be able to look at that and go, you know, /product/ID. Oh, I'm probably getting information about a product. And in the same way with the data that you're sending and receiving, parameters, whatnot, these things should be relatively self-describing. I shouldn't have to go read a ton of documentation just to make a basic call. Now, you know, intricacies and product specific, sure, but just to get the gist of what this thing does should be clear.
No, I love that, especially the developer in me is like, oh, I don't have to read documentation and I can just understand what this is doing from the beginning.
Damn lazy developers never read.
And it's like the documentation's there, right? But it's like it's more fun to just use it and see if I get it right?
I think the other bit though that, you know, so it's like sitting down and designing one API. I think especially, you know, in 2023, I guess maybe 2024 by the time this is out, it's not that hard. There's so many good examples now. I think what's not obviously difficult, but it is designing at scale. So, you know, let's take 100 teams and say you all get to independently design APIs and they're all going to kind of look, feel, smell the same. And when you look at them in totality, you're going to say, oh, this platform is well designed, but they didn't even communicate with each other. That sort of like governance and standards and all that stuff. It is unforgiving, thankless work, but man, it's so powerful when it all comes together.
Yeah. I guess, how do you approach something like that? Like scale is the epitome of all tech at the end of the day, right? Is like something can really work. Something can always work in a small environment, but as soon as you have to scale it, that's where the problem, you really start to see like the leaky flow or anything. So like, How do you approach that, especially as a CTO, right? Like that's like pretty much like the core is setting that governance of like doing things the correct way across scale. So I'm really curious how you approach that.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the core of my session in some ways, because the majority of my career, I've always kind of gone and done like, you know, A round funded startup for a couple of years, reach personal burnout, you know, some critical milestone in the company's lifespan, acquisition, whatever. And then I would go work for like a huge public company. And there's some intention to that, which is that I'm always trying to find like what works regardless of scale. And you know, I don't hate to say it. I love to say it. All of your frameworks and books are meaningless because most of those things are pinned to the particular scale of the writer. Mm-hmm. But there's principles and ideals within that that can be kind of extracted that do just kind of work, right? And I don't know, it's probably some old man thinking here, but it's like sometimes, you know, you just can't get too complicated with stuff. That's how you make things work, regardless of scale. And I think, you know, for APIs, it's like, especially like a lot of the larger enterprises want to just cover every possible use case. And, you know, you end up with big bloated things that no one wants to use. And kind of what was the point, right? And that's where like design can kind of transcend, you know, the organizational size if you're looking at it right.
No, I think that's make a lot of great points. And I think I kind of love what you said about like the books and frameworks are, they're great if you fit into the scale that they were built or wrote for, but you probably don't at the end of the day, unless you work with the person that wrote the book or wrote the framework.
Yeah. My personal mantra is principles, not frameworks. It's like, because I've worked under, you know, I mean, in especially in product management. I mean, these days, product management is like a, you know, people, if you interview for those roles is like, you know, how many of the frameworks do you know? All right. Like that's your qualifier for working there. But if you've worked within some of these things, you know, from a development process standpoint, you know, you kind of start to get the feel that like, oh, a lot of these have the same idea in common, right? Mm-hmm. So why don't we just adhere to an idea for that one thing and kind of put the pieces together that make sense to solve the problems that we have today and not all possible problems in the future.
Right. And I feel like what's weird about, like, not weird about that, but like, that's almost like how people live their lives, right? Is like, you live your normal life, like, pretty much by principles, and then you adapt to your surroundings on like how you apply, like, even like we all have different like personal principles, right? But like you adapt those to your real life, but then you go to work and you follow these specific frameworks step by step by step. It's like you're really working out of your comfort zone and out of what's natural. Yeah. So like, why are we doing this backwards, right? Like,
yeah. And I mean, in fairness, I think it's when you get to really large scale and running a large organization, you know, you have to do some of these things. Right. But I certainly favor, you know, kind of be willing to sort of be malleable with, you know, use perhaps a framework as a starting point if you don't have anything, but quickly adapt it to fit your own setting. Every environment's different. That's definitely the one clear principle that all these varying experiences have taught me is, there is no, you can't just, you know, I don't have a bag of tricks that I pull out and go, okay, here we go. Let's go, you know, build a platform. I'm going to kick back and see, how does this culture work? How does this environment work? Where does it want to be? Right? What's kind of the vision for where we're going? And then, you know, pull out the specific tricks from the bag.
Yeah. I think that's great, right? Especially just like learning about the environment is like more important than just being like, okay, do this. Especially at someone at your level, right? It's like, if you go to a new company at the same like title or whatever, it's like really easy to go in and just be like, we're doing all this now, but A, people are probably just not going to like you. It's not going to work because you don't understand like the culture and the fit of the organization. So it's like, especially if like you're like, especially around like APIs and stuff, it's like, maybe they've been doing something for a really long time that works for them. And like, especially around like microservices versus like monoliths, and then like kind of like the in-between services now that people are doing, like if you just be like, this is how we're doing everything and we need to start like changing everything, it's just never going to work, right?
Yeah. I mean, a few pro tips on the CTO gig. One, it's not a popularity contest. You're often not that, you know, folks are often not that happy with the things that you do.
That's fair.
Accept that, right?
Yep.
You're not going to be liked. And I think, but on the other side is like, how can you kind of enable folks to do their best work, right? That's the key to it all. That's kind of the Jedi mind trick that you're trying to pull off and not have people go off and do whatever the heck they want. But I think all that kind of comes back in API and kind of platform terms, that you know, in our podcast API Intersection, where we've talked to all these people that run, you know, some of the world's largest API programs, down to like people who are just getting started. I think within a few months of anyone making a sort of intentional push for this, they figure out real quick, this is not a technology challenge, right? Building APIs these days is stupid simple. Mm-hmm. It's a culture challenge to get a whole organization to kind of see from a design standpoint and even a technical standard standpoint that this all makes sense, but leave enough room that you have the sort of the flexibility within a given team or a given API product to make it fit its particular use cases, you know, whatever. So that's, you know, it's a big design challenge, but it's a big organization and culture challenge. And it pushes on things like, do you kind of have an inner source mindset, right? Can developers share and kind of swarm on subjects when they suddenly realize, hey, four teams are doing almost the same thing. Why don't we join forces? A lot of organizations have so many guardrails around code and teams that they might want to do that, but they're like, well, there's no way to get around, you know, so we'll just have to deal with it. Keep building four duplicative things.
Yeah, you have four different services that have like basically all the same things being done to them, but are all called from different applications because everything, especially I used to work for Target. So like, we definitely saw that at times where it's like, we were sometimes building the same stuff as other people, but because we were in this org and they were in this org, it didn't matter. And there was definitely a shift towards what you were saying of like, okay, we need to act like we can clean so much of this stuff up. And I think a lot of people probably remember, especially if you're in America, is like Target had a huge outage on like Father's Day. I think it was 2016 ish. And like, that's where like, there was like a huge shift of like, okay, we need to clean this up because like it was the big switch to like API, like single services that do one thing, and like we're going to clean up all this like cross communication, and it was just a big shift, and it takes a lot to do that, especially at the scale of someone like Target. But it ends up being so much healthier for the organization as a whole, and like as developers, right? Like, you get to work on one thing that other people are also working on, but you get to do it together. And in my opinion, is like you end up with a better product when you have people with like similar mindsets, but different, right? And like, that's kind of always been my favorite part of tech, is like getting to talk to people that work in almost the same thing, but always have differing opinions. Then you kind of butt heads and then end up with a better product. Yeah. If everyone's a yes man, right? Like, it's just one person makes the decision and it just rolls. And I don't like that at all. So.
Yeah. No, I mean, as a CTO, I think, you know, multidisciplinary effort, right? So if you look at a team, is not a group of engineers of people attached to them. The team is all of the different, you know, whether that be product or design or whatever. If you really have everyone working in kind of multidiscipline all in one subject, and you can get multi-team collaboration, that's the magic, right? That's when like product magic happens. That's where like I can envision, hey, I think this is how this product should work. But if I can get that engine going and I give them that idea, they'll come up with incredible things that are so much better than I could have imagined, right? And I think a lot of kind of the platform building effort provides that opportunity. But, you know, so many companies are kind of scared to take the risk or the perceived risk. I actually don't think the risks are often that big. What's even more depressing for me, though, is when, especially, and I've really validated this with a lot of other kind of, you know, gray beards, is the kind of mid market companies, right? Like your fast moving, fast growing, mid-sized startups, where, you know, you would normally in any kind of tech stuff, you look to that space to say, what's next, right? Mm-hmm. Like what are we going to innovate in tech? And from like API governance and kind of platform building, it's a depressingly horrible state. Because there's so much pressure to build so fast. People go, well, that's going to take too long. Let's just ship the next thing. And this is how all this transformation junk is born, right? Is from that midpoint of scale on up to being kind of a large enterprise, there's just, you know, people are throwing things at the wall. And it eventually catches up. And like you said, it usually tends to be something catastrophic happens, So right. I certainly always encourage folks like, hey, if you're at a 500 to 1,000 person company, start now. Like, don't wait till you're 3,000 people and suddenly you have a massive data breach because you had zombie APIs that no one documented, or, you know, you didn't have an identity standard. You made something up. You didn't use OAuth or one of these things. And, you know, you have a very embarrassing breach that can be very dangerous to people depending on the domain you're in, right? Start early. Just start basic, right? Make a one pager of standards and get the ball rolling. If you gotta start from scratch at 3,000 to 5,000 people, you're in for a 2-year haul to make progress.
Yep. Yeah. There's a point where it's like you've been running so fast and it's like in the mindset and like built into the company, but now it's time to slow down. Like take a breath.
Yeah.
Gather your things, document it, and clean stuff up before you continue to press the gas pedal.
Yeah, but often by that point, you know, you've dealt with some kind of exit event, and there's actually in some ways more pressure to grow. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's still the same kind of, hey, we don't have time for this kind of mentality until everything breaks, right? Yeah. And so it's
and then
like,
you're trying to clean it up like from the aftermath, which is, I mean, could be the like more detrimental than like spending that time previously.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, and so I like though that you call out that really being intentional about designing a platform and kind of straightening things out, it is about slowing down. But with that pressure to grow, so many leaders look and say, well, you know, I read in Harvard Business Review that, you know, APIs are, you know, a competitive advantage and that you're going to innovate more and move faster as an engineering team. So let's go do that. And then 6 to 12 months in to building a program, they go, okay, we're not going faster. What's happening? It's like, no, you got to slow down to speed up when you're building platforms.
Yep.
To your point, you got to take a breath, take stock of how do all these puzzle pieces fit together? What is the picture this paints as a whole? That's going to be hard. It's going to take a minute. But once we start building that, every step, things get easier, get smoother, the tooling gets better. So yeah, I usually tell folks like, you know, if you're just kind of getting the ball rolling, you've probably got a year or two of lots of arguing over stupid stuff like, you know, dashes and underscores or whatever other convention that you're going to quibble about. Write them down when you agree on them roughly and just keep chipping away at it. And within a year or two, you'll find that things are a heck of a lot better.
Yeah. I love that you probably just made a bunch of developers mad with the underscore and developer and the dash thing. So.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Gotta hit them where it hurts, right?
When you work with enough teams on what their opinion of like good looks like, at some point I'm like, I don't care. Just pick something. It doesn't matter. Like, it really doesn't. It's just your own language background inflection on it, right?
Yeah. One with linters so much now, it doesn't even matter anymore. It's going to fix it for you. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for sure. Like, I mean, Spectral, our open source thing, is like practically a standard now for linting open APIs. And it's so great. Like, I mean, sitting around trying to remember what the standard was and you got all these tabs up. Now, like 90% of that, you just write a couple of simple rules and it's taken care of. And you can have a discussion about why does this thing exist? How does it fit into the big picture? Mm-hmm. And most importantly, the thing that so many people forget, like who's going to use this and how is it going to bring them value? Right. Yep. Let's look at this through their lens and stop quibbling about all the silly technical standards that most people don't care about.
Yeah. It's like you forget about the why we're even building it in the first place.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. I guess like you kind of hinted at it is like the medium sized like issue right now is like that's kind of where we look to see what's going to be the next big thing, right? And like you said, there's kind of like, especially in like APIs, there's kind of like a stall of like what's going to be next and what's, and I see like a rise in like API management and like no code design, that kind of stuff. I'm curious on like how you feel about that and if it's like really going to be beneficial and like what might even be missing already that like it's like still pretty early in like the life cycle, right? But there's probably things missing already that we're just overlooking.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. So it's funny because like there's so many of these kind of no code type things that I look at and I go, I mean, it's a prototyping tool. It's great. Mm-hmm. Like you can build something really quick and, you know, kind of get that MVP or whatever and test out an idea very cheaply and essentially create companies very quickly. And I think it's exciting in the sense that it democratizes things a lot, in that you don't have to have, you know, a 50-person engineering team just to build a product. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think it's a general positive. However, you know, with democratization comes the masses, right? And that doesn't mean more good products. It means more bad products. And however, there's always those diamonds in the rough that have figured out something magical, right? Mm-hmm. And I think this opens the door to those kinds of things happening. So a lot of that was kind of my general opinion for a while. And it's funny, probably like 2 years into Stoplight, where, you know, I'm saying these things going like, most of this no code stuff's kind of a prototype thing. And then I got the egg in the face of, you do realize that Stoplight is kind of a no code tool, right? Like, you don't have to know OpenAPI to design an API. I go, oh shit, you're right. So, I mean, I think as that kind of sphere of influence grows and more things are possible to build that are actually good, maybe there's more hope there. But I think this is probably from another one of my old hobbies of, I like kind of tinkering with mechanical watches, right? It's like building a little engine. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the history of that space, they had, you know, the big kind of attack from Japan with quartz watches in the 70s, where they figured out how to manufacture them incredibly cheap. And suddenly the hand-built mechanical watch, everyone said, it's dead. We're never going to build these again. And literally manufacturers were like throwing away and burning the tooling, because they're like, we're never going to do this. And independent watchmakers who worked for them were taking the tooling home and storing in their attic, saying, you're not going to destroy this. And sure enough, you know, within 10, 15 years, people went, well, yeah, these things are cheap, but, you know, the battery dies and I got to replace it. The thing doesn't wind itself. You know, they're cheaply made, so they fall apart within 2 or 3 years. I kind of miss having that, you know, device that I interact with and I twist the little crown and it winds it up and I hear the little clicks and there's a relationship with this object, right? And I know it feels like I'm going way left field here, but I promise it's coming back.
No, I love it.
that eventually people realize that interacting with a bespoke designed object is special. And I think when I look at the state of software today, everyone goes, well, you know, the bots are going to code everything, right? The AIs are going to manage it all. And, you know, today's code monkeys are tomorrow's ditch diggers, which, for what it's worth, early in my career, I said that many times. But I think there's something we talked about it earlier, when you interact with a product that was built by a multidiscipline, multi-team, collaborative environment, and something special, some magic happens in interacting with that product. And it's like candy, man. You can't get enough. I love using this product. I struggle to imagine that, let's say at least in my lifespan, because that's all that matters to me, selfishly, so call it the next, you know, 20, 30 years. I struggle to imagine sort of machine generated things. And certainly in kind of this, you know, no code, low code thing where you point and click and it does it, that we're going to have, you know, magically engaging products come out of that. And I do believe that we're going to go through a period of it feeling like, you know, engineers' only job is to feed the bots. But I think there's going to be a bounce back from a lot of that into, hey, bespoke, you know, it's great to validate something quickly. When it's time to build the real thing and really scale up, we're going to need engineers to go do this stuff. And we're going to need the rest of the team around those engineers, the designers, the product managers, the tech writers. And that human collaboration, I just believe that there's something special to it that machine generated things won't be better than. Maybe I'm just old and, you know, not seeing the future, but that's how I see it.
No, I'm young and I feel the same way. So like, I mean, everyone's talking about AI right now in this space. Like, it's the big thing. It's the trend. It's where the VC money is going nowadays. Like, which is great, right? Like, that's how tech goes. It's always like, here's the hot thing, here's where all the money goes, and then 6 years down the road, another thing happens. Like, it was blockchain, then it's AI, and yeah, whatever that, is next.
I was gonna say is in the venture capital world, there's not a lot of hindsight.
No.
If you go back and check track records, and this isn't a conviction, it's just a reality, the failure rate of investments is deep into the 90%, right? So just because there's hype, just because there's money going into something, doesn't mean it's a good idea.
Right.
And I'm not saying that I mean, I actually think the generative AI stuff is very promising and has a lot of very interesting potential, scary potential in some ways, but mm-hmm. I think some of the scary stuff's pretty overhyped.
Yep.
The reality is, we don't know what this is good at yet. Where can you point to and say, this has been awesome?
Yep. Like,
mostly we're seeing a lot of silly images, tweaked searches, right? Like, stuff that you go, okay, it's perhaps marginally more useful. I think probably more than anyone is like, content producers are loving having a starting point. Mm-hmm. Right? That's the only thing I've seen that I go, yeah, that's super useful. Generate a base of content that you can then go edit and make sound human and not full of apparitions, right?
Yep.
But
yeah, I was using that to like write docs for a little while. I was like, write this in like a like tech writer way. And then I would go back and like, okay, you can clearly tell this is written by AI, but it's a good starting point of like, and that's where I think like AI is great, especially in like the current, is like that boilerplate stuff where mm-hmm. it doesn't like, it's most of the time, like if we were to go do it, we're copy and pasting it from something else, right? Like we're just copy pasting and changing a few things, but like you can just ask AI to do it and it does it for us, especially in like tech. One of my old coworkers was absolutely panicking about like when ChatGPT was blowing up for like I guess almost a year ago at this point, where it was like really like publicly like available. And he's like, it's going to steal all of our jobs. I'm like, no, it's not. Go look at these responses. Like yeah. It's like most of the time it's just advanced Google search. Like if you Googled this in the right way, it's just doing it for you.
It's and like the first three pages of results and mashing them together, kind of actually what it really is in most cases, at least from the OpenAI stack, is robbing Reddit threads.
Yeah. Yeah, literally. Yeah. I love that one. Cause like, it was super obvious for a long time that it was just robbing the, but I think it's like you said, like there's something about engineers building something that like, maybe it'll go away for a very short time and we'll quickly realize that that was a mistake.
Yeah. Well, I think with APIs, to kind of, you know, bring it back to that subject in regards to the AI stuff, I think there's a lot of friction in going and using a new API you've never used before mm-hmm. in most cases, right? People call out things like Stripe and Twilio because they're remarkably well designed, remarkably well thought out. That doesn't happen very often, mm. right? Most APIs are pretty trashy. Like that's the truth of the matter. And what's funny is we all kind of assume and know by default, well, this is the thing that we are building to make machines talk to each other. So the humans aren't really that important. But then we go, oh, wait, the humans have to write the code to integrate it and they have to understand how it works.
Yep.
So there is real potential to remove a lot of that friction and kind of take a lot of toil away. Things like, how do you make the auth stuff work between different APIs, right? Like if I could not spend day one of a 2-day hackathon on auth, that would be great, right?
The most annoying part is figuring out how I authenticate to this new API.
Yeah, totally. But I think the only way to get there is through things like OpenAPI. I mean, I think at this point that, you know, RAML and Blueprint and these other specs are pretty well, you know, mm-hmm. out of the mainstream. So I look at OpenAPI as kind of the future for that, AKA Swagger is how some people still say it. Without that specification of what the API is, then kind of the AIs are going to struggle to figure out what to do with it, right?
Right.
But if we all have really high quality, good specs provided, then consumption can be highly automated by something that's smart enough to know. And what's interesting, and this is the part that I'm particularly intrigued by, when you work in designing APIs, it's weird how many sort of trained linguists you run into that end up falling into that work. Because there is no interface. There's no graphics, right? I mean, if sure, the dev portal stuff, but if we're just designing the API, it's just a collection of words in some kind of hierarchy. And so it's really comes down to like very sort of primal language concepts in a lot of ways. And you have to question like, what are the assumptions about this word in different cultures, right? So linguists tend to be good at it. But what we're seeing with this wave of generative AI is large language models. And if you really dig into that subject, it's that there is something primal about language that transcends all human culture, right? Language mathematically is the same regardless of which language you speak within a few percent. And almost everything can be described as a language. So when we come back to this design surface that is just language, it's just a collection of words grouped up in some fashion, there's something special there. And I'm not smart enough to get what it is, but it certainly is very interesting. And there are some smarter people thinking about it.
Yeah, I never thought about that, but yeah, that makes a lot of sense at the end. Like you said, it's like it's just a grouping of words, right? At the end of the day, of like how we see it. It's just like, okay, well, and probably it's a grouping of words in a YAML document or whatever, right? But realistically, it's like there is model to that and stuff to like learn from that and to teach other people. And I think like how you bring up linguists is really interesting because like they're trained to see those patterns and understand those patterns. And
well,
it's like, something to think about for sure.
Have you ever taken like, say like a Java or .NET library, something like that, and use like a naive decompiler that will give you the code that's embedded in that library? Mm-hmm. But the kind of simpler, more naive ones will just auto-generate function names. And so you look at it and it's just spaghetti everywhere, right? Nothing makes sense. And like the true reverse engineering of most systems is figuring out what the hell somebody meant.
Yep.
It's not technical in nature, right? It's understanding what was this word that you used. What does metadata mean? No one knows what that word means. It is meaningless, right? And everyone uses it. Everyone wants a metadata something. Like, okay, I don't know what that means. I can't assume anything. I have to dig into the content to figure out what your metadata means.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's very like, I've been a big believer for a long time that like computer science curriculum is way off base in not requiring design courses and requiring language courses. Because they're so fundamental to building anything of scale.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I graduated 6 or 7 years ago at this point. And like, even then, like, as soon as I got into like actual like corporate environment, I'm like, courses are way off of like what actually matters. And like, they teach you how to learn is like, honestly, like what I learn at the end of the day is like, they just taught me how to like teach myself this stuff. But like, is that good? Probably not, right? It should be teaching you, like you said, like design principles and like how to like truly understand what's going on instead of like just teaching you to learn. And I think that's like super important. And I love that you said that because like I've held that opinion for a long time now and I will probably forever hold that opinion.
Well, you know, I'm a dropout, so I didn't stay the course. But, you know, this was kind of mid-90s when if you could just say HTML and knew what that meant, you could get a great job, right? The beginning of the internet when I started. But yeah, my son actually just graduated earlier this year. And it's been interesting to see. I think the idea that computers are a science is true when you get down to kind of the bits and bytes of things. But we work in a layer of abstraction these days that is so far from that. Like, yep. You know, how many real algorithms have you written at work? For most people, yeah, it's zero.
Zero.
Like I've been doing software for 30 years and I think I've worked with like two people working on two specific problems of extraordinary scale that were building real algorithmic stuff. And it was incredible. It's amazing, right?
And some of the smartest people you'll ever meet, like totally. Actually like work on that kind of stuff. But totally. And 99.99% of engineers are not that.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, for the most part, we're pulling and pushing data and trying to make it easy to use. And,
yep.
You know, that could be an API or not. And, you know, by the way, you're, you know, sort of even in a monolith, the way that you design all of your, you know, sort of libraries and how they link together, that's an API too, right? It's just not over the web. So it's mm-hmm. not quite as powerful of an abstraction. And designing that stuff is what we spend most of our time doing, not figuring out, you know, some arcane, you know, computer science concept. It's all pretty basic for most of us. So like, I think, you know, certainly for folks listening, like, go read a design book, right? Like, read books about just fundamental design, because there's ideas in there that are absolutely applicable in computer science. And look at your system not as how is this technically going to perform. That certainly matters. But look at it as, if I handed this to someone and gave them no explanation, what would they think? How would they understand it? That's how you scale an organization more than anything else.
I love that. And I think that's a perfect way to leave it, to be honest. So I just want to know, what's next for you and where can people reach you?
Yeah. So obviously, API Intersection's a good one. You know, we've got a podcast we've had for about 3 years, just an amazing number of, you know, guests. I think we've had something like 60, 70 guests now, across so many different companies and stuff. It's pretty great. You know, other than that, I don't know, I'm pretty quiet on social media these days. I feel like there's no good social medias anymore. But yeah, I'm there on the Twitter and LinkedIn, and easy to get a hold of. So certainly if you have questions or want to chat about this stuff, I'm always game.